Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And I'm getting too old to fight. And all these fears and these feelings I've held inside. And I'm getting too old to fight.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Brad Williams, an Arkansan for 30 plus years, is the front man for the Little Rock country group, The Salty Dogs. The Salty Dogs CDs may be purchased from your favorite digital record store. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. A former house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi, Mark came out of retirement to play for Tales. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Cabot, Arkansas artist Richard Tiffpack, with this piece right over here entitled Old Cowboy, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Richard at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our storytellers all learn in their own ways about conflict resolution. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Joseph Cole's dream comes true and the conflict begins. And we'll end the night with Tyler Thompson's conflict coming on the road. But let's start the night with Madison Hedrick, a schoolyard conflict, and her way out in winning.
It was the first week of the first grade, and I was sitting on one of two tire swings at Pulaski Academy Prep School, twirling around, my jelly sandals kicking tiny rocks as they dragged, when I heard Dylan shout, "Hey Madison, you want to play Red Rover?" This was followed by Colin's, "No, she's not a Red Rover, more like a Red Loser," and the group of boys laughing, their pointing, yelling, "Girls are dumb." Then they began, "Red Loser, Red Loser, Red Loser." This went on for quite a while, until I realized that I better get to the asphalt, and I better win, or life was really going to be over. My experiences in Southern-style sports taught me a lot. You lose at something, and you get yelled at by a coach. You get mocked by a bunch of spoiled little girls, and you face the shame you bring on your family due to your lack of talent. Obviously, if you lose at a challenge on the schoolyard, your parents may even give you to a street urchin. I'd never actually been told that, but it seemed like a sensible punishment for failure. Luckily or not, I was already well immersed in sports by my sixth birthday. I was involved in horseback riding, soccer, swimming, speed skating, competitive cheerleading, and the battle to end all battles, the daily throwdowns between my brother Matt and I. The back seat of Mom's car became an octagon, and we both had the internal drive to just keep going. "Do you want me to come back there?" Mom would yell. Unfortunately, she often did, despite her answer always being no. So the overriding message of my childhood, it was when you get a challenge, you don't back down, and you better win. You better be the best, no exceptions. This competitive spirit led me to one of the greatest intellectual accomplishments I have ever achieved, the first grade reading competition. The challenge, to read as many books outside of class as we could, and then bring a list of each title you read. Confirmed, of course, by a parental signature. This particular competition would last for months. There were already pictures of our laminated heads around the border of our classroom. These would be used to mark our progress in plain sight, with an easy-to-understand game board pattern. Each head marked our place in the competition on the first day. We were all lined up at the starting point, zero. The competition and everyone's progress was the main topic of conversation for each first grade class, each day, for 3 months. The prize? The person who read the most books and won the proverbial race to literacy would have not only their winning laminated face posted high on the wall in the hallway, but they would have their name too. Furthermore, the name would be cut out of bright orange construction paper. In bubble letters, nonetheless. And this would be placed above our picture so that everyone could see the winner's name and face each day for the rest of the year. Oh, wait, there's more. The prize didn't only include bragging rights, there was also a race to compete in. Each competition winner from every class, one per class, competed in a foot race near the end of the school year. So, it wasn't enough to compete and win the educational race, to read more than anyone. You also had the chance to beat other winners and solidify your skills on the blacktop for the whole grade to witness with their very eyes. So cue the Rocky theme song. Obviously, I was in full-blown competition frenzy by the end of the school day. I went home and immediately began to read books. I started with just the simple ones my mom bought me over the years. Honestly, I hadn't had much reason to read them without a competition to win. So, they were all new to me. I was only 6 years old and one of the youngest in my class, but reading came naturally and I improved my skills as the competition took hold of me. By the weekend, I went through more books than I owned. I read all the Goosebumps series and all the classic children's books, including The Hungry Caterpillar, Where the Wild Things Are, Green Eggs and Ham. I then made my mother drive me each day to the library so I could load up on books to read. It didn't matter what was going on, rain, shine, hunger, we were going to the library. And thankfully, my mother knew this was good for me and took me every day without ever complaining, not even once. I ended up surpassing everyone in my class. In fact, the teacher told my mom in the teacher conference that I not only beat everyone in my grade, I read more books than anyone who'd ever participated in the reading competition. How many books? Well, 1,328 books was the final count. Oh, wait. If you want me to do the math, that's 14.7 books each day for 3 months. So obviously they ran out of space for my little laminated head. So I was just sitting in the blank space on the wall in front of the finish line. My teachers were amazed, even though many of them thought it was impossible for such a young girl to read so many books. It wasn't, trust me. I would have read Homer's Odyssey that year if it meant I would win something. In reality, I don't remember the titles of the majority of books I read that year. What I do remember, however, is the intellect all these books provided me. I credit that completion, in fact, to my success as a writer and the scholar, because at an early age, I learned to read. And I learned to read through many, many, many books. Oh, and that whole Red Rover challenge on the playground? Honestly, I don't remember what happened. But since truth is relative, what I remember that day, I choose to see myself running at full speed, hair flying behind me, breaking the chain of boys' arms with wild abandon. Oh, and winning.
Madison Hedrick is a graduate student in the Department of Rhetoric and Writing at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. When she isn't teaching her Comp 1 class, she is writing her thesis. Madison's heart is the dog she comes home to, her best friend, Hunter the Plot Hound. Next, Joseph Cole takes a chance and turns the key and brings on the conflict in Ole Miss Demeanor.
The sky was starless and moonless as I took a deep breath, inserted the key into the ignition, and turned it to the left. To my surprise, the golf cart started. I was in. All the long hours spent testing the administration's golf carts between classes at Ole Miss led up to this moment. I sat in the seat like a proud new car owner and sped away in the blue club car, decaled with the Ole Miss emblem on all sides, feeling like the chancellor parading through the night. Friday started cool and crisp in Oxford, Mississippi. I was a sophomore, and it was homecoming week, and parents were coming to see how their investment was paying off in the tree-lined Greek houses that gather on either side of the Ole Miss campus, separated by the Quad, the Circle, and the Grove. South Carolina was in town, and the Rebels had Houston Nutt at the helm in his first season. The revelry started with 2 30-packs and a fifth of bourbon between six of us after lunch. After the last jigger of Jim Beam, we hurried across the quad to the circle in time for the start of the homecoming parade. We were on the Sigma Nu float, and our theme was Rock You Like a Hurricane, which manifests itself on the float with the Scorpions' Rock You Like a Hurricane on repeat, and a replica of a football field with the Ole Miss logo in the end zones, and a feeble attempt by the pledges, I must say. After the parade, we head back to the house. There was only one thought in my foggy frontal lobes: commence and continue drinking, heavily. The rest of the night was a brownout. After the party was officially shut down, I found myself walking with a young lady I had a summer fling with back to her sorority house through the quad in the Grove. I left the co-ed at her door and stumbled back through the quad, and that's when I noticed a golf cart parked next to the library. Having a club car key jingling in my pocket from the summer's previous employment at a golf course, I decided to try the key, even though previous attempts on various golf carts around campus had yet to be fruitful. And lo and behold, it started right up. A few laps around the FIMU fountain in the quad had me yearning for further exploration. And most importantly, I needed witnesses to this great feat. After driving down Fraternity Row, I arrived at the house and decided to do a few donuts in the courtyard. People were still milling around the upstairs balconies in the chapter room that looked out over the courtyard and pool. The second donut caught their attention. Soon people were rushing outside, whooping and hollering. A mixture of awe, congratulations, and a few responsible observers' admonitions of, "You're an idiot, but that is incredible," were echoed throughout the courtyard. I got out of my blue chariot and ran upstairs to celebrate in the chapter room. My thought process still not very clear, I decided to do a frat lap before politely returning my borrowed plunder. A guy I knew, Andrew, who of course had an unopened fifth of Jim Beam in his hand at 2 a.m., hopped in and directed us towards the Sima Chi house. As we were pulling in behind the house, a University Police Department SUV drove past, spotted us, and slammed on his brakes. We of course ran inside like escape felons and split up. I chose the large communal bathroom to wait out the fuzz. With my legs perched on the toilet seat and crouching like an expectant frog for 15 minutes, I decided that the coast was clear. As I was slipping out of a side door into the cloudy, muggy morning, I again ran into Andrew, who was doing the same. There were two options back to our house, one with the well-lit law school on the left or to the right, behind a fence in the absolute darkness. I told Andrew to go right for the darker, safer route, and I went left. I had been consuming far more than the working man's average day, which might explain why my thought process was again flawed, but I had not a care in the world, as I had just accomplished a life goal of mine, taking an Ole Miss golf cart for a joyride. As I was strolling back to the house, a shirtless and barefoot Sima Chi active came sprinting from behind me like a bear and yelling like a man possessed. As he caught up to me, I told him to relax and that everything was fine and dandy. That's when the cop car nearly ran me over. The cop jumped out, turned me around on the car, and slapped on the cuffs. I was escorted to the scene of the crime less than a football field away, where I was questioned and searched. The officers found my club car key and asked me how I got it. I let them know I worked at a golf course and that it truly wasn't stealing, which was not as strong of a point as I'd anticipated. I admitted to guilt in the golf cart heist without hesitation, and they read me my rights. Then Officer Anderson, the arresting officer, pulled out the Jim Beam from the passenger seat cubby and asked me whose bourbon it was. And since I was underage, I froze like a deer in headlights. But no one likes a rat, so I of course said it was mine. On the way to jail, I did get to sit in the front seat because of my agreeable behavior. I received a lecture from Officer Anderson on the terrible things that happen to people who drink too much and how making these decisions can ruin my future. After sitting in the congregation for about 10 minutes, Officer Anderson left his pulpit to escort me into the receiving area of the Lafayette County Detention Center. They booked me and took what I'm sure was a great-looking snapshot. And to my surprise, the county cops were very nice considering it's 3 a.m. on a Friday night. And there is a bit of wisdom I picked up from my experience. If you were ever arrested in Oxford, be nice, cordial, and respectful to the arresting officers and to the county cops, and you will be rewarded for your good behavior. One reward was a cell with only two inmates, while the drunk tank was packed with over 20 people, complete with a buddy of mine from Memphis and a man yelling that he knew his rights and needed his phone call because, "Don't you know who I am?" over and over. After sleeping soundly for a few hours, I was awakened at 6 a.m. by a trustee that informed me that I could make my phone call. Reward number two. I called my mother at home, and I was promptly hung up on after informing her of my temporary residence. With no other options, after the sobering and unsuccessful phone call to my mom, and also that you can only call a landline from the Oxford jail, I asked the jailer what else I could do. He gave me a card for a bondsman, and I informed the jailhouse savior would be in around 7. The bondsman arrived, and I was escorted to a room where I was informed that my freedom would cost $147. After paying, I was released with my small bag of personal effects, which I carried on my walk of shame into the bright early morning sun, a day ideal for college football. The sun instantly snapped me back in reality. It was homecoming weekend, and my family would be in Oxford in 2 hours to eat brunch at the fraternity house before going to the Grove and the game. I got a ride back to campus, walked in the side door of the house, and immediately went into the communal bathroom with 8 mirrors lined up on one side. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a flash of red before me as I passed by the bank of mirrors. Turning quickly into the mirror, I saw what I had been wearing for the past 18 hours. And the effects those 18 hours had exacted on my body. Bloodshot eyes that were as red as the pants I was wearing, and my shirt, which shook me with surprise and ultimately repulsion. I shut my eyes and did a double take before reading the large block letters on my shirt that said, "Joe, the man, the myth, the legend."
Joseph Bourbon Cole is 25 years old and originally from Jackson, Mississippi. He now makes Little Rock his home. He is an Ole Miss graduate and a Southern gentleman in training. In our final story of the night, Tyler Thompson is just cruising along when conflict races up behind him in My Little Red Corvette.
Cruising along in my Corvette, about 75 miles per hour on the interstate from Little Rock to Fayetteville one Friday night not too long ago, I approached some loaded semis ahead. I tapped my blinker to move over into the left-hand lane to pass that caravan of trucks. As I was passing them, I noticed rapidly approaching headlights crowding my tail. In my rearview mirror, a vehicle soon rode by bumper, flashing rapidly back and forth between high and low beams, apparently demanding that I pull over and let it pass. Being that there were about 10 more trucks to overtake, I decided that that impatient, heavy-footed hot rodder could just wait until I was clear of the truck traffic to my right. After all, I was doing 75, and if that wasn't fast enough for Paul Newman back there, then tough. When there were about 6 trucks left to clear, the driver behind me started honking. I thought to myself, just remain patient. It'll all be over soon enough. Just then, the grade of the interstate started going slightly downhill, which allowed the truckers to speed up, slowing my rate of passing them until the elevation leveled out once again. That didn't make my bumper buddy back there any happier. I just sped up to get ahead of the trucks and rid myself of my uninvited trailer. As I was preparing to move into the right lane, the guy behind me whipped there before I could and floored it past me while flashing some rude hand signals. Then he pulled back in front of me, braking somewhat and then speeding back up. He was driving a Chevy HHR, you know, GM's version of the Chrysler PT Cruiser. That's when my patience faltered. I was in a vet, damn it. And it was showtime. At the age of 59, I finally decided to accomplish one of my life's dreams, owning a brand new shining edition of America's only true sports car, the Corvette. It was 2008 when I took possession of a near candy apple red coupe with a transparent tinted sunroof. It would have been nice to own such an animal when I was in my 20s. but I certainly wasn't able to do so at that time. Even though it was a dream deferred, it nonetheless became a dream accomplished. The only drawback I've noticed is folks saying, "Aren't you a little too old to be driving that car?" To which I respond, "Never too old to drive it. But getting in and out of it sometimes is another story." My parents tell me that my first word was caca. Now, not mama or dada, but caca. And that utterance meant car, as I'd point from my stroller at a new Cadillac or Ford. Later, I became more and more excited about what appeared in U.S. showrooms from the late 1950s onward. I was so enamored about annual American car debuts each fall that I convinced my folks to take me to downtown Pine Bluff every year on a designated September Saturday for new car unveilings and just leave me there for the day. That way I could hike from one end of Main Street to the other, taking in the new models of Chevys, Fords, Chryslers, and other makes, basking in their new car smells, great shining chrome grills, and the new exciting colors and model shapes. At that time, almost all of the major car dealers were on Main Street or one of its cross streets, unlike the suburban sprawl of today's lots. I'd just stroll from one showroom to the next, peeking in the huge glass windows before going in and just drooling over those shiny new finned chariots and fawning over the occasional car displayed on the floor, slowly turning on a carousel. Back then, automakers were major sponsors of network TV shows, and when each fall's new season began, so would the premiere of the Big Three auto ad campaigns. We got the forward look from Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, Chrysler, and Imperial. Ford brought us sales pitches touting their newest advances in auto safety conveniences. And General Motors offered the new, longer, lower, and wider versions of Cadillacs, Oldsmobiles, Buicks, Pontiacs, and Dinosaur inviting us to see the USA in your Chevrolet. Late, I'm kind of dating myself there, I know, but you know, that's what nostalgia is. You know, just dragging as many people as possible along with you down memory lane. Later, when it came time for me to purchase my first car, my sights focused on a second-hand red Chevy Impala convertible, which honored my parking spaces for over 20 years. Then I drove a Dodge Charger and a couple of sporty Honda Accords, if that's not an oxymoron. A deep green Cadillac STS followed, and then a BMW Z3 welcomed me into its driver's seat for more than a decade. I finally made the move to pursue the idol of my childhood dreams in September of 2008, a new Chevy Corvette. And it was this baby that I was driving that night on the interstate when the Chevy HHR challenged me. Glancing in my side mirrors, I saw that the trucks were safely behind, then moved right and floored it. I quickly passed that munchkin car as the road's grade started to climb for a long stretch. Next thing I knew, he had wound up that rubber band under his hood enough to overtake me and cut in front of me again. I looked at my speedometer and saw that I was going north of 100 miles an hour and decided that this just wasn't worth it. I took my foot off the accelerator and let the car slow back down toward the speed limit. I knew what my baby could do. Certainly didn't need to prove it to someone like that four-banger midnight racer. Just beyond the crest of the hill, under an overpass, sat a state trooper in the median, who started flashing his blue lights in the night like he had caught a whopper and was eager to reel it in. You see, the guy in the HHR didn't slow down like I did. Guess he was enjoying a victory lap of sorts. Well, that didn't last long, because by the time I passed the fisherman and his catch of the night, the speedster was shaking his fist at me out his car window. I just coasted down the interstate in the left-hand lane, keeping clear of the law enforcement official, tending to business on the right-hand shoulder. Isn't that what the law requires of us motorists?
An educator and optometrist, Tyler Thompson has written nonfiction books on music and religion. He enjoys writing as much as he likes eating delicious meals cooked and served here at Starving Artist Cafe. He asks that you give it up for the kitchen and wait staff. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Here I stand behind my phone, and I start to sing another country song. Play that one about a love that's gone wrong. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? Won't you take me back home? And I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Round and round, where they stop, well, I don't know. Another smoke-filled country bar, another show. Trying to find a friend in a crowd of I don't know. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home? I miss my wife and my daughter most of all. Wheels, won't you take me back home? Wheels, won't you take me back home?
brighter accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.